Hello and welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll examine a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin and go to the UK to speak with David Patrikarakos, a journalist and a fellow at the Institute of Iranian Studies at the University of St. Andrews. We'll discuss the possibility of reintegrating Iran into the international fold and a strategic realignment in the Middle East following the nuclear deal with the P5+1, as well as David Patrikarakos' recent article in the New York Times, Iran, From Enemy to Ally. Then we'll speak with writer, journalist, and professor Mark Denner about his provocative and widely read article in the New York Review of Books, Rumsfeld's War and Its Consequences Now, and the new film about Rumsfeld by Errol Morris. Mark Denner teaches at the University of California, Berkeley, and at Bard College, and is the author of The Secret Way to War, The Downing Street Memo and the Iraq War's Buried History, and Torture and Truth, America's Abu Ghraib and the War on Terror. Then finally, after months of unnecessary delay, financial regulators today voted to finalize the Volcker Rule, a key provision required by the Dodd-Frank Wall Street Reform and Consumer Protection Act. Micah Hauptmann, the Financial Policy Council at Public Citizens Congress Watch Division, joins us to discuss the Volcker Rule's implementation after fierce lobbying by the banks and whether or not the five big banks who dominate the $300 trillion domestic derivatives market will be reined in or find ways around the new law. And joining us now is David Patrikarakos, who is a journalist and an associate fellow at the Institute of Iranian Studies at the University of St. Andrews. He is the author of Nuclear Iran, The Birth of an Atomic State, and he has an op-ed in the New York Times, Iran from Enemy to Ally. Welcome to Background Briefing, David Patrikarakos.
Hi there, Ian.
And David, when you talk about the idea that Iran can transform from an enemy into an ally, I guess we have to take into account John Kerry's recent remarks, where he, of course, was involved with these very negotiations that brought about this hope and this thaw in this frozen and hostile relationship that's gone on since 1979. Kerry himself is basically saying, given the history, we are all rightly skeptical about whether people are ready to make the hard choices to live up to this deal. So that's what he's telling the U.S. Congress. And as you know, the U.S. Congress is poised to even vote stiffer sanctions, which would, in effect, scuttle the deal.
Yeah, I mean, look, it's a very, very complex issue. And when I talk about transforming from an enemy into an ally, in my op-ed, I do stress that this is very much a long-term goal. It's not around the corner. It's not going to happen overnight. But I think what is clear is that over 30 years of not talking to the Islamic Republic hasn't worked. It hasn't succeeded in moderating their behavior. And it simply was, you know, a wrong policy in the end. I mean, a few years ago, I was part of a team that interviewed Nick Burns at Harvard in Boston. And he made the point that throughout the Cold War, the U.S. had an embassy in Moscow. They'd even spoken to the North Koreans, but they hadn't spoken to the Americans. Now, the recent deal is only an interim deal. It's only the very, very start, but let's hope that it is the beginning of some sort of rapprochement, because I think this is needed for both the U.S. and for Iran, but it's going to be tough.
Well, of course, that was one of the ironies of the Axis of Evil speech under George W. Bush, that the three countries he named in the Axis of Evil, Iraq, Iran, and North Korea, none of them we have any diplomatic presence in any of these countries. And so we have to rely on overhead intelligence and other people's embassies. And by not talking to people and by casting them as pariahs, in a curious way, you not only do you cut off contacts, but you also cut off intelligence.
You do. But the interesting thing is that by making the Islamic Republic pariah, in many ways, it strengthened the hardliners in Iran. Now, you know, the Ayatollah Khamenei and the hardliners grouped around him, they based their legitimacy on resisting the great Satan. So actually, Obama's attempt at detente in 2008, when he came to power, was very, very problematic for them because, you know, they couldn't very well say the great Satan was trying to destroy Iran when he wanted to shake their hands. Conversely, actually, the aggressive rhetoric of the Bush administration was a bit of a godsend for the mullahs. So I think actually that, you know, reaching out to Iran, trying to achieve some kind of deal, does strengthen the moderates there, and I think that's very important.
And David Patrikarakos, your recent piece in the New York Times, Iran from Enemy to Ally, you point out that in 2003, fearing American military action, Iran reached out via the Swiss to American officials. I've spoken with Colonel Lawrence Wilkerson, who was Compound's chief of staff, who was in the White House at the time. And he basically said that the Iranians were putting everything on the table because they were afraid that they'd be next after Saddam was toppled. But that Dick Cheney basically said, we don't talk to evil, and that was the end of it. Is that your understanding?
That is my understanding. I mean, a lot of controversy does surround this. I spoke to John Bolton, and he said that it never happened. But I have heard exactly what you have heard, and that phrase keeps coming back to me, we don't talk to evil. I think, given what has happened subsequently, that it was an error, and an unfortunate one at that, and I think we'd be in a much better position had that deal been accepted. But the point I was making in my op-ed is that the Iranians will compromise. Now, you need to put pressure on them. They're not going to give things up easily. And the only reason they're at the negotiating table now is because of the sanctions, which are really, really scorching the Iranian economy. You know, the mullahs are in trouble. But, you know, 30 years of economic mismanagement has now been accentuated by these oil and banking sanctions. When you hit Iran's oil, its primary source of foreign exchange earnings, you really hit them where it hurts. So the sanctions have been effective. You do need to apply pressure. I think it's about taking that pressure now and seeing that we can, trying to move as far forward as we possibly can.
Again, I'm speaking with David Patrikarakos, who's a journalist and associate fellow at the Institute of Iranian Studies at the University of St. Andrews. He is the author of Nuclear Iran, The Birth of an Atomic State, and he has an op-ed at the New York Times, Iran from Enemy to Ally. So it's not that long ago, as you point out in your op-ed, that in the 1970s, Iran and Saudi Arabia formed Richard M. Nixon's twin pillar strategies to counter Soviet influence in the region. You're also suggesting here that if Iran were to basically come back into the fold, then that could check Chinese access to critical energy. It could affect what's happening in Lebanon with Hezbollah and in Israel and the Palestinian territories with Hamas, and then also in terms of the Syrian civil war, which won't be ended, to your mind, and without Iran's participation. I've talked to a few specialists who said in many ways that it is that the isolation that Iran feels that's driven to this point. But is there any evidence that they're prepared to give up their position in any way? Because the difference between the Iranians and the Russians' support for Assad and the ambivalent support that the Americans and the Europeans have had towards the Syrian rebels is pretty stark, is it not?
Yes, I would agree with that. I mean, Syria is a difficult case. I mean, you know, my thoughts on that are that, you know, Iran's influence in Syria, if they can't be convinced to use their influence positively, then at least involving them might get them to use it less negatively. Now, it is very difficult because I think that the Iranians consider the fall of Assad an existential threat. So I'm not really sure what you could do, really. I think that's just a case where they just have completely different interests. You know, I think on Hezbollah, on Hamas, these sorts of things that they did put up for debate before, you could get a lot of traction, you could get a lot of mileage out of that. And the key that I keep coming back to is this, is that Iran, you have to deal with Iran. It's 70 million people. It geostrategically sits between the Caspian Sea and the Persian Gulf. It's on the Straits of Hormuz. It's critically important. It's huge, huge oil and national gas supplier. You have to deal with Iran. Keeping it boxed up, keeping it isolated, keeping it artificially weak cannot last forever. So let's engage with them as best we can. Obviously, let's not be too soft. Let them get away with stalling even more on the nuclear program. But we have to engage Iran. For 30 years, we didn't, and it didn't work. It didn't moderate their behavior. It didn't make anything better. And I think now is the time to move forward.
But conversely, while we have isolated Iran, we have embraced the Saudis. And the Saudis acted as the key in terms of oil prices because of their surplus capacity. They can affect oil prices. And is there a concern in the West with the U.S. and with Israel and certainly with the Saudis that if Iran, which has a lot of influence in Iraq, thanks to George W. Bush, Cheney, Rice and Rumsfeld boneheaded invasion of Iraq, all that ended up doing was in effect, you know, handing over Iraq to Iran, there's no question that Iran has enormous influence over Iraq.
If you combine the massive oil reserves in Iraq with Iran's oil reserves, you have a much, much more powerful oil player than Saudi Arabia.
Yeah, I think that's true. I mean, I think the relationship with Saudi Arabia, you know, was built on oil. There doesn't quite, you know, a need for oil, a U.S. need for oil, a Western need for oil, it doesn't quite exist to the same degree. I mean, especially thanks to new fracking technologies, the U.S. is becoming a huge, huge source of oil itself. Now, it doesn't mean that the Saudis can't affect oil markets. Of course they can. But I think that their, you know, their influence is perhaps slightly waning. And I think they, you know, there's serious problems with the Saudis. Their funding of Salafist and jihadist groups has caused huge problems for U.S. interests, for Western interests across the globe. And for, you know, for Muslims across the globe who have suffered as a result. Don't forget that the primary targets of these forces are other Muslims. So I do think that it could be time to see a slight shift or emphasis away from the Saudis, not necessarily towards the Iranians immediately, but just perhaps to start trying to sort of recalibrate various relationships in the Middle East.
But while the Saudis do have this duplicitous role where they fund Wahhabi extremism that's manifests itself all around the globe, and they are funding the al-Nusra and the extreme elements in Syria, they're saying that it's not the government, it's wealthy Saudi individuals that are doing it. But that's a little hard to swallow, is it not, given how tightly the al-Sauds run that country with their ubiquitous intelligence service and, of course, the religious police?
Well, look, one can't say for certain, but I do agree broadly with what you're saying. You know, I think that, I mean, okay, you get rogue elements like bin Laden, of course, but I think by and large, the country is pretty tightly run, especially when you think how large the royal family is, about 5,000 members, all of whom have their own little groups who are dependent on them for patronage. It's a very tribal, very interconnected system. So I would agree with what you say, yes.
Well, but the further point would be then that the Saudis, if their role in funding the Taliban, obviously al-Qaeda came out of Saudi Arabia, they've also funded madrasas, etc., in Pakistan that pushed that country towards a, well, shall we say it's to some extent destabilized Pakistan. That's the role of petrodollars in terms of funding radicalism. Is there a potential on the Iranian side, if they get their oil up and running and if they could also have influence over Iraqi oil, would the same threat exist? Because under Ahmadinejad and other radical groups, they did fund radical groups around the world. They appear to have backed off a little on that, but does the potential exist?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, look, they're big funders of Hamas, they're big funders of Hezbollah. Yeah, they're huge funders of radical groups. It's slightly different, and I think it's more political rather than ideological. I mean, certainly Hezbollah is Shia as well, but Hamas obviously isn't. And I think that these are sort of geostrategic power plays as they push and fight for influence in the region. And I think that they're generally slightly more pragmatic about it. I mean, you know, the sort of days of wanting to export the Shia revolution, you know, of 1979 are long gone. It was pretty much burned out of them during the Iran-Iraq war. So I think it's slightly different in tenor, but absolutely, Iran, you know, Iran funds pretty unpleasant groups. But this is my point, you know. I mean, how do you stop them doing it? How do you try to stop them doing it? Well, it hasn't, you know, you haven't stopped them doing it for the last 20 years. But as you say, in 2003, they promised, you know, they offered it on the table. They were going to potentially discuss giving it up or at least putting it on the table to discuss. So, you know, that's the sort of way to go, I think, you know, bring them to the table. Use whatever leverage you can, integrate them in slowly and over time without being naive, because I know that this is the criticism often thrown at Obama. But I think, and I keep saying it, you know, now is the time to engage. And I'll repeat myself again, 30 years of not talking achieved nothing. You have to move forward. It is complex. Iran does a lot of very unpleasant things. But it's just, you know, a question of working towards lessening some of those unpleasant things. And I believe the way to do that is to talk to them.
But as much as Obama is getting pushback from the U.S. Congress, who are threatening to scuttle the deal by ramping up the sanctions on Iran, which would be a deal breaker, it's pretty clear from Israeli Prime Minister Netanyahu where Israel stands. He's been against any kind of rapprochement with the Islamic Republic, and as even there have been rumors of a military strike for the longest time. But what's interesting in your article is you point out the extent to which Israel and the Iranians have always had a fairly close relationship. So Walk us through that, and because I'm trying to understand how you're in effect arguing that maybe Netanyahu doesn't see the forest from the trees. Is that what you're saying?
I think to a degree you're right, yes. I mean, look, as I say in the article, Iran is a Persian Shia state and Israel is a Jewish state. Both of them are outsiders. They're predominantly Sunni Arab Middle East. Both are subject to isolation. This happened to Iran during the Iran-Iraq war, when pretty much all the Arab states, apart from Syria, sided with Saddam. And it's happened to Israel since its founding, over 60 years ago. You know, they were allies under the Shah of Iran before the Ayatollah Khomeini came in the 1979 revolution. Israel and Iran were discrete allies. That would not have been possible at that time between Israel and any other Arab state. Iran took part in none of the wars against Israel. It's never lost any territory to Israel. And they, in fact, have a convergence of interest. And don't forget that even after the Islamic Revolution, when all the fiery anti-Israeli rhetoric began, that Israel and Iran still cooperated. Between 1980 and 1983, Israel sold Iran $500 million worth of weapons in its fight against Iraq. They provided advice, military advice, all these sorts of things. And, you know, during the early 1980s, when Iran was in disgrace with Washington, in rightful disgrace with Washington, following its disgraceful seizure of U.S. diplomats during the hostage crisis, Israel lobbied for Iran in the early 80s, you know, despite the rhetoric that was coming out of Tehran. I mean, you have to understand a lot of what's behind the rhetoric, which is, you know, the Iranians are Persian Shias. When it comes to the Palestinians, they don't really care that much about the suffering of Sunni Arabs. I've been into Iran, been around it, the people don't really care. Conversely, when I go to the Arab world, it's a very, very sore issue. But Iran, again, is always isolated in the Middle East. So what it does is it ramps up the rhetoric. It proclaims itself a self-proclaimed champion of the Palestinians. And it receives a lot of credit on the quote-unquote Arab street. So Arab governments have to be very, you know, slightly more careful about criticizing Iran because of this, because they're, you know, fearful of their own populations. I mean, one of the interesting things was, for years, you know, I was speaking to Arabs, and they were terrified of an Iranian bomb, terrified of an Iranian bomb, far more scared than they are of an Israeli bomb, when, you know, Israel has nuclear weapons. But they wouldn't say it publicly. You know, publicly, they couldn't be seen to be criticizing Iran and therefore almost, if you like, siding with Israel. Iran has done this very, very cleverly.
Well, I think to buttress what you're saying, Sheikh Nasrallah, the head of Hezbollah, became a hero for not – obviously, he didn't win the last war against Israel, but he still was standing when the war was over, and he became a hero on the Arab street. But my understanding is that, you know, the pendulum has swung in the opposite direction because of Hezbollah's involvement on the side of the Alawite regime of Assad in Syria.
Absolutely.
So perhaps that's basically moderating Iran's position vis-a-vis the Palestinians, because the Palestinians themselves are having second thoughts, aren't they?
Absolutely. I mean, you know, I reported from Lebanon a couple of years ago, and, you know, it's a big problem because, you know, before the Lebanese were the champion of the underdog, you know, in the Arab, you know, in the Arab world's eyes. And now, you know, they're certainly not the champion of the underdog anymore when they're helping Assad to butcher his own people. I mean, the last 10 years has been sort of up and down for Iran. As you rightly say, you know, in 2001, the Americans removed the Taliban, one of Iran's most pressing security concerns. 2003, they removed Saddam, Iran's other most pressing security concern. They recalibrated the Middle East in Iran's favor. But recently, things have been changing. You know, the problems with Assad is a big problem for Iran. They're very, very worried that if Assad falls, it's going to be bad news for the Iranians. They're losing a lot of legitimacy in the Arab world through their own help of Assad. If it wasn't for the Iranians, Assad would have fallen a long time ago. Their proxy group, Hezbollah, is now losing legitimacy in the Arab world. So these last couple of years have not been good for Iran. And it comes back to my point as to why they're at the table. On top of what I've just said, they have huge sanctions against them, and they're more isolated than at any other time in the history of the Islamic Republic since the Iran-Iraq war. They're in trouble.
Well, David Patrikarakos, I thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you.
Again, I've been speaking with David Patrikarakos, who's a journalist and associate fellow at the Institute of Iranian Studies at the University of St. Andrews. He is the author of Nuclear Iran, The Birth of an Atomic State, and he has an op-ed in the New York Times, Iran from Enemy to Ally. We're going to take a brief station break and we'll be back talking with Mark Denner about his provocative and widely read new article in the New York Review of Books, Rumsfeld's War and Its Consequences Now.
ای فدای اون همه اطربوی تو، هر زمان دل می کشد پر به سوی تو، هر کجا پا می نهم سر فرود آرم، قبله گاه من شده خاک کوی تو.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Mark Danner, who is a writer, journalist, and professor. Mark Danner was a longtime staff writer for The New Yorker and is a regular contributor to The New Yorker Review of Books. He teaches at the University of California, Berkeley, and at Bard College, and his books include Stripping Bare the Body, Politics, Violence, War, The Secret Way to War, The Downing Street Memo, and The Iraq War's Buried History, and Torture and Truth, America, Abu Ghraib, and the War on Terror. His latest article at The New Yorker Review of Books is Rumsfeld's War and Its Consequences. Now, welcome to Background Briefing, Mark Tenner.
Thanks, Ian. It's good to be here.
And Mark, the your article in the New York Review of Books, which is the first of how many are you writing on Rumsfeld, by the way?
Well, the second one just closed, so I believe three will probably do it. I hope.
Well, are you finding it as difficult as Errol Morris did in his new film, which I haven't seen, but I've been reading reviews about it? Apparently, Errol Morris refers to this film of his as a work of hate as opposed to a project of love. You know.
Well, you know, I think this film will inevitably be compared, and I certainly compare it to Errol's film made that appeared just a decade ago, called The Fog of War on Robert S. McNamara. Both films, of course, are on defense secretaries. Both are on extraordinarily willful, stubborn, domineering, and extremely intelligent men who were very successful early on in their lives. And then found themselves confounded in both cases by wars that they couldn't win, and wars that they really weren't that thrilled to be fighting for a long time either, by the way. Both wanted to get out very, very quickly. And both now are really, I think, much to their displeasure. McNamara, of course, is gone now, but his displeasure was very clear in The Fog of War. And Rumsfeld is still with us. And both, I think, will be known by their failures in these conflicts in Vietnam and in the Iraq War. To get back to your point about Errol, we can't speak for him, of course, but I have a feeling, or at least a suspicion, that McNamara was a lot easier to interview in many ways than Rumsfeld has been. McNamara was a man who wanted very much to explain himself, who, in a sense, had been seeking redemption ever since he left office, '67, I believe it was, and who wanted desperately to explain himself. Rumsfeld is a very different kind of fellow. He seems to be, at least, convinced he is always right. I say seems to be because there is a kind of opaque surface, which I talk about in the New York Review of Books piece, which is rather maddening. You know, you can't get by this surface. And confronted with this, Errol, in a sense, dwells on the surface. So it's rather a different kind of film than The Fog of War. I suspect people will be frustrated that Errol doesn't quite get Rumsfeld. Get, I mean, you know, grab, trap, etc. That Rumsfeld tries and perhaps succeeds in many cases in wriggling out of his grasp. But I think that impression while understandable, is mistaken. I disagree with it. I think Rumsfeld, in many ways, rather traps himself. And I guess one of the points of of the New York Review piece that's in the current issue and the one to come is to show the reader and the viewer in what way Rumsfeld has trapped himself.
Well, I recall from the Fog of War, the film that Merrill Morris did about McNamara, that McNamara was really quite tortured, and he came up to the cusp of a mea culpa, but never quite delivered. And Rumsfeld is I think both he and Cheney, and because Showtime did a documentary on Cheney as well, they seem to be blissfully immune to the reality of what they have wrought. Their smugness reminds me of Somerset Maugham's great line that the great comfort to the mediocre is that they're always at their best.
Oh, boy. That is I didn't know that line and wish I had. That's a wonderful line. You know, it's an interesting problem, Ian, what they really think. I mean, I'll confine what I have to say to Rumsfeld, because that's what the piece is about and what I've been thinking of, or the person I've been thinking of. It's hard to know whether what you're getting is a reflection of a kind of smug self-satisfaction with what indeed he has done, and a refusal really at all to come to grips with some of the failures, which of course are very striking. The Iraq War is only the most obvious. Or what you have here is the public face of a man who has been a politician and a quite successful one from a very young age, and is very schooled in how to put to the public a face that is always triumphant, that is always, what's the word, all-knowing?
Confident.
Self-confident, you know, a face that is completely without doubt. And I think that is perhaps what we're seeing, this face without doubt. So it's very frustrating.
Well, that's the point that I was making, though, in quoting Somerset Maugham, that you know, if you look at the record of both Cheney and Rumsfeld, not going back to the Ford administration, but since their time in the George W. Bush administration, it has been a spectacular catastrophe. And everything that they thought they were doing, they did the opposite. They thought they were liberating Iraq when, in fact, they handed it over to Iran. They've diminished America's standing in the world. They thought they were standing tall on the world stage. In fact, they've shamed and weakened America. It's just extraordinary how they're not being held to account. And when you this serene confidence that they have is you know, a part of why they are so mediocre. They don't get it. I mean, and they never will. And that's, of course, I guess, the comfort of being an ideologue.
Well, it's a good question whether there is any introspection, as I said, and whether, you know, if you ever were able to get Rumsfeld or Cheney, for that matter, to sit down and honestly talk to you about what they really thought about the Iraq War. I certainly expect Rumsfeld, in particular, would not cling to the view that everything worked fine and, you know, it was a successful effort. I don't know that he would confess it was a failure on the level that I agree with you it was. I have to believe, I guess I'm saying, is that he is more introspective and thoughtful, certainly, than he comes off in this film. But remember, I think what they would probably say, and certainly to some degree what Rumsfeld does say, and it's something I take up not only in the first part, but even more in the second part of this New York Review essay, is that history, you know, he has a kind of strange, almost mysticism about history. And it's mocked to some degree in the title of Errol's film, The Unknown Known. Some of your listeners will remember in a press conference in which Rumsfeld was asked, you know, where are the weapons of mass destruction? Or do we really know where they are? He launched into this little mini excursus in philosophy, saying, well, you know, they're known unknowns. These are things we don't know, but we know we don't know them. Then there are unknown unknowns, things that we don't know and don't know we don't know. And these are the horrible things that you have to watch out for. And in the film, he applies this characterization, for example, to the attacks on Pearl Harbor in 1941 and the attacks, by implication, the attacks of September 11th. And it's rather fascinating because, in effect, he has, you know, all of this sort of mystical philosophy about history, all these famous Rumsfeld rules and so on. And one of my arguments really is that all of this stuff is deeply political and self-protective. You know, it's a way for him to say, this wasn't my fault. You can't know history for certain. You know, all you can do is try to imagine what might happen, but you can never do this successfully. And if you follow this kind of thinking, you end up with a kind of cosmic get-out-of-jail-free card. You know, it's, well, you know, what can we do? Yes, we went into Iraq, but and things went badly, but wars never turn out to be the way you think they will be. You know, this always happens. And he says even more excruciatingly to me, he makes a similar point when it comes to torture and the so-called enhanced interrogation techniques that he approved for Guantanamo, and that then, as various commissions testified that investigated these things, migrated, that's their word, migrated to Iraq and were seen in the form of the grotesque Abu Ghraib photographs. You know, he holds that, you know, you can't see around corners. Who could have expected that when I approved these enhanced interrogation techniques that had been legally vetted and judged to be safe and humane and so on, who could have expected that, you know, what you would end up with is the Abu Ghraib photographs? And I find this absolutely repellent, to tell you the truth. And I go a long way, particularly in the second essay in the New York Review of Books, to prove that indeed this is not the case and that it was foreseeable. And indeed, one of the best moments of the film, Errol Morris's film, The Unknown Known, is when Rumsfeld claims at a certain point, well, you know, it's ridiculous, he says, that anyone could claim that what I approved at Guantanamo could have migrated to Iraq and Abu Ghraib. These things have nothing to do with one another. And as is his custom, he pointed to a specific report that he said proved the opposite. And Errol Morris, to his great credit, and it's in many ways the high point of the film, has the report in his hands, basically. I mean, figuratively speaking, he has the quote. And even as Rumsfeld says this in his defense, Errol actually reads out the quote, which says the precise opposite of what Rumsfeld is claiming it says. And it's a kind of a great moment in the film because he is a man who has very often succeeded by citing things that, in fact, prove the opposite of what he says at the time. But people very often haven't read the reports. They're not familiar with them. And he's come a long way simply by simple bravado and arrogance and aggressiveness. And Errol, to his, I think, enormous credit, you know, catches him in the act, as it were. One of the most interesting things is Rumsfeld, after he's been caught in this way, simply sits back and says, oh, yes, I guess that's true. He doesn't admit he's been prevaricating. It's really a remarkable moment. And in fact, it's worth the price of admission, this little exchange. But of course, we have to remember at the end of the day that, you know, we're talking about, you know, we can talk about the Iraq War. We can talk about what it did to the U.S. position in the Middle East, to the position of Iran, and so on. Very, very relevant to this moment, of course. But we can also talk about, I think, you know, these enhanced interrogation techniques and what they did not only to the reputation of the United States, what they did not only to its political position by greatly helping the jihadists, greatly helping al-Qaeda and its allies, but also the effect they had simply on what the U.S. is and thinks it is. You know, its respect, very often honored in the breach, absolutely. But its role in promoting international law. And I think these decisions were absolutely disastrous for the country, absolutely disastrous. And I think that the film is valuable, very much so, in that it confronts this. And I've tried to, you know, write about this in the New York Review of Books and try to bring out these strains, not only in Errol Morris's movie, but also in Rumsfeld's enormous memoir, and in a very good book about Rumsfeld by Bradley Graham, a biography which is called By His Own Rules. So these pieces are about not only the film, but Rumsfeld's memoir and another biography as well.
Well, it certainly it takes quite a mind detached from reality to even entertain the idea of humane torture. But again, I'm speaking with Mark Danner, writer, journalist, and professor, longtime staff writer for The New Yorker and a regular contributor to The New Yorker Review of Books, where his latest article is Rumsfeld's War and Its Consequences Now. One of the interesting parts of history that you bring up in the article about Rumsfeld, Mark Danner, is this story about the father, George H.W., the idea that both George H.W. and Don Rumsfeld were sitting in hotel rooms at the Republican convention when Ronald Reagan was about to be named president, wondering who he would pick as his vice president. And of course, the phone rang for George H.W. and not right. for Donald Rumsfeld, who really thought he had the inside track. And by in the Ford administration shunting off George H.W. to the CIA, he thought he'd gotten rid of him because he couldn't run for VP. It gives you an idea of the arrogance. And, of course, you know, it's also worth reminding ourselves that Dick Cheney actually ran for president, you know, at one point.
Of course, he
was spectacularly unsuccessful.
he was indeed. Yes, no, I remember. I actually interviewed him around that time. The backstory, as it were, which is just these men's biography, which you referred to earlier, is a fascinating one. I mean, the first thing to know is that Rumsfeld was enormously successful at a very young age. He was in his early 30s when he was elected to Congress from Illinois. He became very quickly one of the more influential congressmen, in part through his connections to Gerald Ford and other key figures. He joined the Nixon administration when he was in his late 30s. He had cabinet rank. He was running agencies. He was chief of staff to Gerald Ford. He saw Watergate from close on. He was chief of staff to Gerald Ford and then secretary of defense when he was in his early 40s. And Dick Cheney, of course, began work in Washington as his deputy, as his aide. In fact, Cheney used to joke when they were in the George W. Bush impression. He would introduce him by saying, he'd introduce Rumsfeld by saying, "I think of Don Rumsfeld as a fine secretary of defense. Don Rumsfeld thinks of Dick Cheney as a fine assistant to Don Rumsfeld." So these two men had a long history.
Right, they were a powerful tag team too.
That's why they
rolled over the kid, didn't they? That's the part we're running out of time. Just in the last minute here, the fact that they rolled over the kid and basically he didn't know what end was up. Why did the father not intervene, particularly on the going into war against Iraq?
Well, I think, you know, there are a couple of answers to that. One answer is you could say he did intervene in the form of Brent Scowcroft's celebrated essay in the Wall Street Journal, which was titled, I think, "Don't Go Into Iraq." Mm-hmm. And, of course, Scowcroft was national security advisor to George H.W. Bush, very close to him, had written a couple of books with him.
Sure.
So this, most people assumed that this was coming from the father. The interesting thing here, of course, is that this kind of father-son rivalry is borne out in the very person of Rumsfeld, which, as you said, I bring up in this first New York Review of Books article. When George W. Bush was thinking of who to hire for Secretary of Defense, and Rumsfeld was a candidate, James Baker, who'd been Secretary of State to George H.W. Bush and was kind of the family consigliere, said to George W. Bush, "You remember what he did to your daddy," meaning don't hire him. He was a jerk to your father. He shunted him out of the way. And, of course, George W. responded by hiring him.
Oh, God.
So there is a kind of, you know, you think, and Rumsfeld says in the film, well, he proved he was his own man, he says about George W.
Right. So, well, we don't have time to get into eatable matters here, but I thank you so much for joining us, Mark Danner. Again, Mark Danner is a writer, journalist, and professor, and a longtime staff writer for The New Yorker. He's a regular contributor to The New York Review of Books and teaches at the University of California, Berkeley, and at Bard College. And his books include The Secret Way to War, The Downing Street Memo, and The Iraq War's Buried History, and Torture and Truth, America's Abu Ghraib and the War on Terror. His latest article at The New York Review of Books is Rumsfeld's War and Its Consequences Now. We're going to take a brief station break. We'll be back talking about the implementation of the Volcker Rule.
Oh yeah, yeah, oh yeah, yeah. War is not the answer. Politician and them bubble niggas thing. War is not the answer. I simply know what the solution Rasta says. War is not the answer. Pretend the politician and them start drop them bomb. War is not the answer. I simply know what the solution Rasta says. War is not the answer.
Right there, that's the postman asleep in the sand. He's got a get well card to deliver. He's gonna do it by hand. He's gonna do it. 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 He's gonna do it by hand.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Micah Hauptmann, who is the Financial Policy Counsel at Public Citizen, a national nonprofit consumer advocacy organization. Tell me, Micah, you're basically in favor of these new Volcker rules that have finally come into play after an enormous amount of obstruction to the implementation of the Dodd-Frank Wall Street Reform Consumer Protection Act. Others, of course, like Bill Black, who put all of the crooks in jail during the savings and loan, following the savings and loan disaster of the 1980s, is pretty critical of it. So let me begin with the good news.
Well, the good news is there are many positive aspects of the final rule, and the final rule was considerably stronger than what regulators initially proposed. So we're happy about that. But there are still considerable amount of opportunities for banks to engage in prohibited proprietary trading and disguise that as permitted activities. And so we're concerned about those opportunities that banks could engage in. But at this point, we're cautiously optimistic, and now it's on to the regulators to make sure that they implement it vigorously.
But in Bill Black's main critique, I guess, is that the failure to repeal the Glass-Steagall Act is really at the heart of it, and that this is a compromise. And unless you really repeal the repeal of the Glass-Steagall Act, you're not going to really address the problem.
Well, it's true that this doesn't get to the full implementation of a, let's say, 21st century Glass-Steagall Act, but it does have that spirit. The Volcker Rule is designed to stop banks from engaging in proprietary trading, and that's really speculative trading purely for their own profit instead of in service to their clients. And one of the chief causes of the 2008 financial crisis was banks engaging in proprietary trading, often high risk, could result in large losses, which in turn exposed banks and the financial system to distress. And the current iteration, the Volcker Rule, does have some exemptions and exclusions that are not as robust, that don't make the rule as robust as, let's say, Glass-Steagall, but it does put us in the right direction, and it's a pretty sizable step forward toward a safer financial system.
But essentially what we're talking about here is the power of the five largest banks who do virtually all of the financial derivative trading by U.S. banks, are we not?
That's right. That's right. The Volcker Rule is pretty narrow in scope in that it only applies to the largest, most systemic banks that are trading for their own account. And medium-sized banks and community banks don't prop trade. They give loans to customers. They take deposits. They operate like traditional banks, because they are traditional banks. It's the largest banks that have combined their investment functions with their commercial lending functions that this would apply to.
And again, I'm speaking with Micah Hauptmann, who is the Financial Policy Counsel at Public Citizen, a national nonprofit consumer advocacy organization, where he is the counsel for Public Citizen's Congress Watch Division. So this is obviously needed because we have the recent example of J.P. Morgan's $6 billion trading loss in 2012 from the so-called London Whale in London. I'm curious to know why it is that the banks like J.P. Morgan and the other four of the big banks have fought so hard through their lobbyists to emasculate the Dodd-Frank Act and to prevent this kind of regulation that's finally coming in with the adoption of the Volcker Rule. You would think that given the losses that they would actually be in favor of it. So what is motivating them to fight so hard to prevent the Volcker Rule's implementation?
They have fought very hard, and it's because prop trading can be a giant source of revenue in good times, although it can be a source of loss in bad times, as we saw in the financial crisis, and again with the London Whale trading debacle. I should point out that banks sought to broaden the hedging exemption within the Volcker Rule, and the final rule was much more targeted and narrow. And so we're pleasantly surprised by this fix, and we think that another London Whale would not be likely to occur, because banks are going to have to document their trading and prove that they are engaging in hedging specific risks for specific purposes in specific ways, and they can't just claim that they are hedging risk just broadly, which Jamie Dimon originally claimed before he changed his tune, and he said that it was a hedge gone wrong.
So do we know what the outstanding potential debts or the amounts of derivative trades are? I mean, I remember some time back, Warren Buffett referred to derivatives as financial weapons of mass destruction. What is the outstanding number on derivatives that are out there? Do we know?
So globally, it's almost $700 trillion notional value. But domestically, I believe it's around $300 trillion, and banks can still deal in derivatives under the Volcker Rule, but their ability to profit based on high risk speculative activity based on derivatives is going to be curtailed.
So you're saying it's how many? $350 trillion? Was that what you said?
I believe that it's about $300 trillion domestic, but that's notional.
Right. Well, but let's just do the math. $300 trillion domestic, and the annual GDP is what, $14 trillion?
I believe it's about $15 trillion, yeah.
It's up to 15 now. So just do the math. I mean, compared, how many years of GDP is that? It's like 15 years of GDP or something. No, it's more than that.
It's a sizable amount. The derivatives market is quite substantial.
So explain to our audience the difference between if this derivative market is about, what, 20 times, more than 20 times the annual GDP of the United States, when you say it's notional, what does that mean?
The notional is the amount of that is referenced. So a derivative references either an asset, let's say an asset going up or down, or interest rates going up or down, or a company succeeding or failing. And so the value that's assigned to the underlying occurrence or the asset is the notional value. And so that's not the amount that is changing hands between the different counterparties. And so often you can have a contract, a derivatives contract, for $100 million, but only tens of thousands of dollars are actually changing hands between parties.
So what are the roles then of the Federal Deposit Insurance Corporation who've adopted these rules and the Commodities Futures and Trading Commission that's supposedly to police these rules?
So there are five agencies in total that adopted and will be implementing the rules. And let's see if I can name them. It's the Federal Reserve, the FDIC, the Office of the Comptroller of the Currency, the CFTC, and the SEC. And so there are the banking, the prudential regulators that are going to make sure that the banks are engaging in safe and sound activities and that their safety and soundness is preserved. And then there are the market regulators, the CFTC and the SEC, that are going to enforce and make sure that the markets are working properly. And so that's in the securities and derivatives markets. So they have different missions, but all of them working together are going to make sure that the Volcker Rule is hopefully implemented properly, and they're going to oversee and enforce markets to make sure that that the banks are in compliance.
So given the history of these big, powerful banks, the five biggest banks, and their deployment of legions of lobbyists on Capitol Hill and lawyers, are they likely to basically accept the Volcker Rule, or are they going to, behind the scenes, nibble away at it to death?
I guess we'll see. Time will only tell. I'm already hearing that banks are looking to sue regulators, I guess on a variety of fronts, on this rule, and they've already sued on a number of other proposed and final rules under the Dodd-Frank Act. So we'll see what happens there, but I would imagine that if a rule is adversely affecting their bottom line, they're going to not sit quietly.
So if indeed the banks do, which I think is reasonably predictable, what then will the Congress do? It's pretty clear that the Republicans have, and many Democrats on the banking committees, have sided with the big banks. So it's been a real uphill battle to implement Dodd-Frank, which of course came in after the 2008 crash. And since then, of course, memories fade and lobbyists have their day.
That's right. And only about one third of the required rules under Dodd-Frank have been finalized. And so we still have a long way to go, although today is should be a victory for consumers and for taxpayers. I'm pretty happy that even though we were outnumbered in lobbyists, in lobbying for the Volcker Rule, Public Citizens, members, and supporters sent 15,000 of the approximate 18,000 total comments to regulators on the Volcker Rule. So we did have a pretty sizable influence, and we should be happy that the rule came out stronger than was initially proposed. I think that we'll see if the Volcker Rule is implemented as Congress intended it, then I think that we'll be in good shape and banks will be made substantially safer. However, if regulators decide that I guess they should just go home today and don't implement it vigorously, then we'll have to consider other ways to make the banking system safer, and that includes passage of 21st Century Glass-Steagall Act, which Senator Elizabeth Warren has already proposed.
Again, I'm speaking with Micah Hauptmann, the Financial Policy Counsel at Public Citizens Congress Watch Division, and we're talking about the implementation today of the Volcker Rule, named after Paul Volcker, the first chairman of the Fed under Ronald Reagan, followed, of course, by Alan Greenspan. Volcker apparently did get the ear of President Obama. Apparently he's an impressive guy and much more down to earth and more in touch with the people of this country as opposed to the esoteric Alan Greenspan, who was completely blindsided by the 2008 crash. So, and of course was the executor of Ayn Rand's will and was a devotee of that strange lady's Darwinian philosophy. So he kind of got marginalized, didn't he, within Obama's inner circles, by Tim Geithner, Treasury Secretary, and, of course, the sort of ubiquitous Larry Summers, Obama's economic advisor. Is that your understanding?
I think there have been differing accounts. Paul Volcker was definitely not in the inner circle of the White House. However, his influence in getting the Volcker Rule to be one of the strongest pillars of the Dodd-Frank Act is pretty impressive.
So somehow he survived the apparent sniping that went on within the White House. At least there have been pretty substantial reports to that effect.
That's right. And despite Tim Geithner's apparent opposition to the Volcker Rule.
And now, of course, Tim Geithner has taken a job with a big investment bank on Wall Street.
I believe he's working for a private equity firm. Currently.
That's right. Well, just in closing then, Michael Hartmann, give us a sense of we, you know, I started out by talking about Bill Black's criticism that's saying it's not enough, and you've said that the 21st century new Glass-Steagall Act is in the wings. Senator Elizabeth Warren is offering it up as a kind of backstop. How long do you think we'll know before the Volcker rules are actually having the effect that they've intended to have?
Well, unfortunately, it won't be for a while because the conformance period has been delayed a year to July 2015. So we have about now a year and a half to wait to see for banks to be in full compliance with the rule, and then we'll see what their trading activity looks like. But if regulators don't put forward the Volcker Rule and implement it with strict oversight and enforcement and really change the casino culture that has dominated on Wall Street these last couple of years, then we will be looking for Congress to stand ready to pass Senator Warren's 21st Century Glass-Steagall Act.
Well, Michael Hartmann, I thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you so much, Ian.
Again, I've been speaking with Michael Hartmann, who is the Financial Policy Counsel at Public Citizens Congress Watch Division, which is, of course, a national nonprofit consumer advocacy organization. We've been talking about the implementation, finally, of the new Volcker Rule. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program's available for podcasting at ianmasters.com. You can also contact me, and I'll be back again tomorrow with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.